I have the power. Well, what the hell's the presidency for? He could use only a modicum of presidential power as yet. He couldn't, daren't, rage and threaten and bully as yet. But whatever power he had, he was going to use. And no one knew how to use power better than he. If there was only one lever, Lyndon Johnson was going to push it. Telephoning Bolling on Monday evening, December 2nd, after reading O'Brien's memo, he was cautious at the start, wary of saying something that, if quoted back to House leaders, would offend them as presidential interference in their affairs. He hoped Bolling would not discuss the call with them, he said. I want to keep this secret. I don't want them to be thinking I'm going around them or anything. You just keep this confidential. But give me your ideas about what are your prospects up there. But when Bolling told him the prospects were bad, our maximum Democratic signatures on the petition, about 160, would be obtained pretty quick, he said, but Republicans were balking, and Smith's flat refusal to even set a date for hearings convinced me that we absolutely had to go this route or we wouldn't have any lever at all. Secrecy gave way to urgency, as Johnson spurred the congressman to the cause, rallying him as he had once rallied young senators to civil rights. For an example of him rallying, see Master of the Senate, pages 970 to 975. Rallying him and guiding him, telling him what to say to colleagues uncertain about signing the petition. Was Smith refusing even to hold hearings? I think you can really make a point of that, he said. Just say that the humblest man anywhere has the right to a hearing. You, civil rights supporters, have been denied any opportunity to be heard at all, and the only way you can be heard is on the House floor itself. And therefore the petition should be signed so that the bill could be discharged to the floor for debate and a vote. That was what should be said to Democrats, he told Bolling, who responded, right. As for Republicans reluctant to sign, they should not be allowed to say they were in favor of a civil rights bill and were refusing to sign the petition only because they didn't want to overturn traditional House procedures. A vote against the petition was not just a procedural vote, he said. It was in reality a vote against civil rights, because without the petition a civil rights bill had no chance of passage, and they should be told that. Anyone who is for civil rights is going to be for signing this petition. If they are not for civil rights, all right, but don't hide behind a procedural thing. Anybody that wants to be anti-civil rights, that's their right. You've got no objection to that. They can do what they want to. Right, Bolling interjected. But they can't pretend to be for civil rights and then say they won't sign the petition, Johnson said. Let them sign the petition. The number of signatures on the petition was important, the president told the congressman. The more you get to sign it, the better. Smith had released the bill in 1960, only after the judge had realized that there was a real possibility that the bill might be taken away from him by force. Trying to ascertain exactly how many signatures Bolling was counting on, however, Johnson found the count disappointingly soft. In the order of 160 Democrats, Bolling said. As for the Republican number, well, that's up in the air. The president got specific about one state. Are you going to get any from Texas? He asked. Well, I don't know, Bolling said. Johnson said he would make calls to some Texas congressmen. The petition had to be filed, he said. I think it's got to go. And when Bolling said, this is the only lever we've really got in our arsenal, Johnson said, I agree with you. I agree with you. I agree with you. If there was only one lever, Lyndon Johnson was really going to lean into it. The African Americans who were the leaders of the five key civil rights organizations, Roy Wilkins of the NAACP, Whitney Young of the National Urban League, Martin Luther King Jr. of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, James Farmer of the Congress of Racial Equality, CORE, and A. Philip Randolph of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, had requested a group meeting with him, but a group meeting wasn't what he wanted. What about one meeting a day for each, were the instructions Juanita Roberts jotted down. The one-on-one meetings had already begun in a meeting with Wilkins, the dean of the group, on the Friday, November 29th of Thanksgiving weekend, and on Monday, the day of his conversation with Bolling, with Whitney Young. Before the week was out, he would also meet with King, Randolph, and Farmer. His conversations with these men were conducted at the informal end of the Oval Office, the civil rights leader sitting on one of the couches in front of the fireplace, Johnson sitting in the rocking chair. Since the rocker was higher than the couches, the president towered over the men he was speaking to. Becoming worked up as he talked to them, he leaned forward in the rocker, over the coffee table, closer and closer to them, his eyes never leaving theirs. Coffee cups sat on the table between them, untouched, as he told them how to advance their cause, and tried to persuade them that he believed in it. He persuaded them. Aware though these men were of the political considerations that motivated the president, from the descriptions of these conversations that they were later to furnish, there emerges a picture of a Lyndon Johnson who, in their opinion, had a genuine passion for social justice. Wilkins's feelings toward Johnson, for example, had always been ambivalent. "With Johnson, you never quite knew if he was out to lift your heart or your wallet," he was to write. But now, seating Wilkins on one of the two sofas, Johnson pulled his rocking chair, Wilkins says, "within a few inches of my knees," and began talking about the Civil Rights Bill and how hard the South was going to fight it. But Johnson also said, Wilkins recalls, that such a law could be enacted if the people really wanted it. He was asking us if we wanted it, if we would do the things required to be done to get it enacted. And Johnson said, as Wilkins recalls, that the outcome, the very future of our country, depended on how we all handled ourselves over the next few months. It wasn't merely the words, but the passion behind them that moved Wilkins. "It was the first time I had really felt those mesmerizing eyes of Texas on me. When Lyndon Johnson wanted to sell an idea, he put all his being into the task. Leaning forward, almost touching me, he poked his finger at me and said quietly, 'I want that bill passed.'" A passion rooted in empathy, a deep understanding of the indignities visited daily on black people in America. "Some of the Southerners tell him that they'll buy the bill if he will take out the public accommodations section, but he can't do that because that's the heart of the bill as far as he is concerned," James Farmer recalls him saying. And Farmer recalls, when he asked Johnson how he got that way, the president told Farmer how when Lady Bird had told Zephyr Wright to take their dog to Texas when she drove down, Mrs. Wright had replied, "Please don't ask me to do that, because we're going to be driving through the South, and our trip is going to be tough enough just being black without having a dog to worry about, too." And how Mrs. Wright had explained how hard it was in the South for a black person, even a college graduate like her, to find a place along the main highway to eat or to go to the bathroom. "Well, that hurt me. That almost brought me to tears. And I realized how important public accommodations were," Johnson told Farmer. And then the new president added that he had determined that if I ever had a chance, I was going to do something about it. He said he was running into great difficulty with the Civil Rights Bill, Farmer recalls. "But he's got to get that bill through. He's got to get it through. It's of vital importance." And from these descriptions also, there emerges a picture of a Lyndon Johnson who was hard, tough, canny. Tough enough and canny enough to transmute passion and empathy into the legislative accomplishment that had been so lacking during the past 3 years. When he had entered the Oval Office for his conversation with Johnson, Wilkins had not had much hope for the Civil Rights Bill. If it passed, he felt, it might do so only on a drastically watered-down form. Kennedy, he was to recall, believed that his package would have passed Congress by the following summer. "I'm not quite sure how much of it would have survived." But by the time the conversation ended, he had been struck by the enormous difference between Kennedy and Johnson. Where Kennedy had been polite and sympathetic on all matters of basic principle, more often than not he had been evasive on action. Kennedy was not naive, but as a legislator he was very green. He saw himself as being dry-eyed, realistic. In retrospect, I think that for all his talk about the art of the possible, he didn't really know what was possible and what wasn't in Congress. When it came to dealing with Congress, Johnson knew exactly what was possible. Johnson made it plain he wanted the whole bill. "If we could find the votes, we would win. If we didn't find the votes, we would lose," he said. The problem was as simple as that. Wilkins had entered the Oval Office without much hope. That wasn't the way he left it. The votes he was talking to them about now weren't for the Civil Rights Bill, the president explained to them. They were for the discharge petition. Because without the petition, there might never be a vote on the bill. While he was talking to Young, who was sitting on the sofa to his right, Soapy Williams telephoned, and Johnson took the call, leaning in front of Young to lift the receiver off its cradle on the telephone console on the coffee table. "We're going to go all out on this civil rights bill," Johnson told Williams. "But we've got to go the petition route, and that's a mighty hard route, as everybody knows." The public had to be made to understand that a vote against the petition was not a mere procedural matter, but a vote against civil rights. "We've got to put the Republicans on the spot," he said. "Halleck was on television yesterday saying, 'Well, we've got to have hearings,' and the bill was rushed through, so it shouldn't be discharged by petition." "Rushed my ass. It was there, in the Judiciary Committee, from May to November. But he was telling how it was rushed. So we've got to find some way, somehow, to make the public understand that these people, Republicans, either go with us, sign the petition, or they're actually anti-civil rights." "I'll take care of the bill itself," Young heard the president say, but he needed help with the petition. "We'll all work on it. Everybody will have his assignment. We're on the same team." These black leaders had been fighting in the streets with, some of them, the tactics of the orator, and some of them with the tactics of the revolutionary. Sitting on the Oval Office couch, the long telephone wire stretching in front of their faces up from the telephone console on the coffee table to the receiver in Lyndon Johnson's hand, they heard in a Texas twang a president fighting with the tactics of the legislator. To a legislator, what counts is votes. Not merely explaining to Martin Luther King the importance of sufficient signatures on the discharge petition, he showed him a list of the congressmen who had not yet signed, pointed to the Republican names on it, and told King to work on them. The five civil rights leaders believed him, were convinced of his sincerity. Besieged by reporters, Young told them that a Magnolia accent doesn't always mean bigotry. The new president, he said, not only supported his predecessor's civil rights program, but had deep convictions of his own. The other leaders echoed Young's feelings. "I left the White House that day convinced that Johnson was willing to go much farther than he had ever gone before," Wilkins was to write. Despite his passage of the 1957 and 1960 civil rights bills, there has been a lingering reservation in the minds of many Negro leaders whether Mr. Johnson, a Texan with close friendships among Southern legislators, wholeheartedly subscribed to the far-reaching Kennedy program, the New York Times said. His meetings with the five leaders, the Times said, had erased their reservations. The statements some of them made to reporters as they left the White House showed a certain relief, summarized tactfully in Martin Luther King's statement that, "As a Southerner, I am happy to know that a fellow Southerner is in the White House who is concerned about civil rights." Their feeling was not only for public consumption. Speaking privately to two of his aides later that day, King told them, "LBJ is a man of great ego and great power. He's a pragmatist and a man of pragmatic compassion. It just may be that he's going to go where John Kennedy couldn't." After these conversations, they believed in him. The speeches Lyndon Johnson had given as vice president had made some of them start to look at him in a new light. To Wilkins, who had studied them closely, they could have been written almost by a Negro ghostwriter. The descriptions the knowledgeable NAACP lobbyist Mitchell had been giving them for years about the difficulties in getting, in 1957, even the half a loaf, even the one crumb that they despised, had finally made them understand the magnitude of what Johnson had accomplished. And now, sitting with him in the Oval Office, they had talked with him themselves, had looked into his eyes. They had felt what Howard Woods had felt 3 years before, sitting across from Lyndon Johnson on the campaign conveyor. One evening later that month, on December 23rd, the phone would ring in Roy Wilkins's apartment. It was 10:30, and Johnson was still in the Oval Office, still signing mail, he told Wilkins. But he had something he wanted to tell him, that he was about to hire a black secretary, Jerry Whittington. "This Negro girl that's been working for Ralph Dungan, she has good character and good ability. You come on and you meet this woman the next time you're in this White House." And, Three or four things he wanted to talk to him about. Suggestions about whom to appoint to the Civil Rights Commission. What to include in his January State of the Union address. Wilkins's opinion of a California state official he was considering appointing to a White House job, because he was not only competent, but a Mexican, and they've had nobody in the White House. It wasn't merely blacks he wanted to make a part of his administration, but other minority groups as well, he said. After those matters had been discussed, Johnson was about to hang up, but Wilkins had something he wanted to add. "Now, Mr. President," he said, "may I just say a word to you? I hope you're going to have, first, a Merry Christmas. And I'd like to say this to you. Please take care of yourself."
I'm going to,
Johnson said. "Please take care of yourself," Wilkins repeated. "We need you." If Lyndon Johnson, dealing with Wilkins and Young and King and Randolph and Farmer, about matters which concerned at bottom the color of their skin, was fooling these men, he was fooling men who were, where color was concerned, very hard to fool. He wasn't fooling them, wasn't merely posturing. No television cameras had been present, no reporter taking down his words, when he had sat on the steps in Catulla with the janitor Thomas Coronado. If there was only one lever, Lyndon Johnson was going to put his shoulder into it, as became apparent on Tuesday, December 3rd. Not only the civil rights organizations, but civil rights' staunch ally, organized labor, had to be mobilized behind the civil rights bill, and labor's stud duck, who liked the visible signs of consultation, the pictures of the two of you, was invited to the Elms Tuesday morning for breakfast, and a ride downtown afterwards. No sign of consultation was necessary to line up the staunch old leader of the unions behind civil rights. Meany had been behind that cause for 30 years. But he hadn't been behind Lyndon Johnson. As Johnson's limousine nosed slowly out the Elms gates, the rear window was down so that photographers could snap a picture of Meany in the back seat with the president. And at the White House, Johnson asked Meany if he'd like to come inside, and ushered him into the cabinet room to spend a few minutes at the legislative leaders' breakfast. When he emerged to be met by the waiting White House press corps, he said that the president would have labor's full support in the battle for the civil rights bill. Johnson would have had that even without the breakfast and the cabinet room. But, AFL-CIO lobbyist Andrew B. Miller would say, this cemented Johnson with Meany. After Meany had left, Speaker McCormick said Judge Smith's recalcitrance meant that getting the bill to the Senate early enough in 1964 for there to be any realistic hope of passage there was going to be difficult. "We cannot expect any action by rules, not even the setting of a date for hearings, until the middle of January," he said. "A discharge petition was the only thing we can do, but a lot of members don't like the discharge petition as a matter of policy." Although he had given Bolling the go-ahead for the petition the previous evening, Johnson's first comment about the maneuver at the breakfast seemed to be merely in agreement with McCormick's reservation. Then he added, however, "Psychologically, the petition, would be good for the country. All you are asking is a hearing." Sentiment around the table moved toward a petition. Firming things up, he made sure they were all in agreement. "Does everybody agree that you get as many Democratic signatures on the petition as you can? Then tell the Republicans they must match us man for man." Bringing the discussion to an end, he said that when he himself had been in the House, "I was always reluctant to sign a discharge petition, but you have a great moral issue." McCormick had harbored some doubts, small but persistent, about whether Johnson's commitment to the bill was as strong in private as in public. Had been hoping, he had told a friend the day before, for some definite word. After that breakfast, he knew he had it. He told the waiting reporters that the discharge petition would be filed as soon as possible. And Johnson was not only laying out a strategy on Tuesday, he was counting the votes that would be behind it. The first counts he received were an illustration of why bills hadn't been getting passed. House Majority Leader Carl Albert of Oklahoma assured him of 165 Democratic signatures for the petition, but when Johnson asked the House Majority Leader and the other leaders specifically where those signatures would come from, since so many Democrats were from the South and border states, No one seemed to know. And even if the 165 number was correct, 53 Republican signatures would be needed to reach the required 218. And as Albert was to confess, he had no idea how many Republicans would sign. When Johnson pressed the majority leader at the breakfast, his answers were the answers of a man who only thought he knew. "Where do you get your count of 165?" Johnson asked him. "We may have trouble getting it," Albert had admitted. "I think 150 would be more like it." "That includes 20 Republicans," Majority Whip Boggs chimed in. "What good is thinking to me?" Telephoning Albert after the breakfast, Johnson asked, "Can we make a little poll of our own? Congressmen should be asked one by one, each by the Democratic assistant whip responsible for knowing his views." "Just start going down them by whips," he said, "and get answers that could be relied on. Thinking isn't good enough. I need to know." "Just say to each whip, now we've got to know, and this is it." Counting the votes and getting the votes. Larry O'Brien arrived on Capitol Hill with his assistants, and soon the Hill was buzzing with reports of the pressure the White House was putting on congressmen. And Meany was not the only labor leader Johnson was contacting. "We're going to either rise or fall on the results of the petition," Johnson had told Dave McDonald of the steelworkers. "And I think if there's ever a time when you really talk to every human you could, you ought to do it. If we could possibly get that bill out of the Rules Committee, we've got to get 219, sick. Until we get 219, we'll be a failure. And if we fail on this, then we fail in everything." "I'll have all my legislative people report to Nordy immediately," McDonald had promised. And on this Tuesday, when his call to Johnson was put through while the president was talking to Martin Luther King, the steelworkers' lobbyists were working the Hill under the direction of Frank Nordhoff, Nordy, Hoffman. "We've got 33 guys at work covering 45 states," McDonald told Johnson. "Our boys are staying on top. We still haven't contacted North and South Carolina, Georgia, or Tennessee, but that'll be done today." "Well, you won't get that many votes there," Johnson said. "No, but we can put the muscle on them," McDonald replied. Getting the votes himself. Albert's 165 or 150 or 130 or whatever count of petition supporters did not include any from Texas. Since the state was still so overwhelmingly Southern in its racial attitudes, getting any would be hard. A key to getting them, however, could be Albert Thomas, whose appropriations subcommittee chairmanships and access to Brown and Root campaign funds made him a congressman to whom other Texas congressmen paid attention. Thomas was an advocate neither of civil rights nor of interference with House prerogatives. And when Johnson first asked him about the petition, he said he was against it. He was, however, an advocate of appropriations for Brown and Root projects, such as the deep ocean drilling project called Mohole, and wanted assurances that Johnson's budget economizing wouldn't extend to the annual appropriation for that project that added so substantially to Brown and Root's annual profit. And he wanted to know also that he would continue to have the final say over matters before his subcommittees, that the new president wouldn't interfere with that. Giving him what he wanted, Johnson told Thomas that he would rely on your judgment on the National Science Foundation before I send my budget up there, but coupled this assurance about Thomas's influence with a request that he use that influence for civil rights. When that morning Thomas had said he was against the petition, Johnson, as he was to relate to Homer Thornberry, told him that nonetheless, I sure hoped he'd sign it, and he said all right. After all, Johnson said to Thornberry, Republicans, the party of Lincoln wouldn't do anything to help it pass. And in fact, Thomas quickly called together the members of the Texas delegation whose districts did not include large numbers of African Americans. And after that meeting, Thornberry said the petition would have 6 signatures from Texas, 6 more than it had had before. Covering the House of Representatives for the New York Times that Tuesday, Anthony Lewis felt the mood shifting, and by evening he understood the reason why. Sitting down at his typewriter, he wrote his lead. President Johnson threw his full weight today behind the effort to pry the Civil Rights Bill out of the House Rules Committee, pointing out that It is extraordinary for any president to give direct support to a discharge petition. Lewis said that the petition procedure is unusual and it rarely works, but the president's intervention could provide the psychological push to get past those obstacles. It hadn't taken long for the president's intervention to begin having an effect, he wrote. By this evening, he said, there was some evidence of a dramatic impact on the situation in the House. One veteran legislator, Lewis wrote, had told him, "It is too turbulent to predict anything certainly now, but I've never seen one before where we've had the president going and the civil rights groups and labor and the church people." And in fact, it didn't take long at all. The next day, Wednesday, December 4th, the headlines were made by the Republican leaders of the House, who at a conference of the chamber's Republican members that morning denounced the discharge petition. "This move for a petition is irritating some people, who otherwise would have supported the civil rights bill," warned Ohio's McCulloch, ranking Republican on the Judiciary Committee, announced that none of the leaders would sign it and predicted that few other Republicans would either. The consensus appeared to be that the Rules Committee should be allowed a reasonable time to hold hearings and act on the bill before a petition was used, Conference Chairman Gerald Ford told reporters. Not a single congressman had spoken in favor of a petition at the conference, Ford said. "Rights bill stymied," the Washington Star was to proclaim the next day. "House GOP scorns plan to force action on rights," the Times said. Those headlines, however, didn't take sufficient account of other meetings that day, among them two at which Johnson spoke, the first with the Business Advisory Council, 89 of the nation's biggest businessmen, the second with the 20-member AFL-CIO Executive Council. At both of the meetings, the president showed again his gift for political phrase-making. He had found his phrase now. Just as a key to his strategy was to make the public understand the issue, to make the public understand that Republican congressmen voting against the petition were actually opposing civil rights, another key was to make these congressmen wary of voting against it, to let them know that their vote could put them in an embarrassing position. And he had found a phrase that would dramatize the issue vividly. A phrase that would touch with Republican congressmen because they were, after all, members of the party of the president who had freed the slaves. It was a phrase that had a ring to it, and Johnson knew it. Over dinner with old colleagues that evening, he told them what he had said at the two meetings. "I talked to both of them about the party of Lincoln." He had indeed, and had hammered the phrase home. After telling the businessmen that he knew that most of them were Republicans and, due to fundamental philosophical differences, might be his opponents, but that, nonetheless, "I am the only president you have. If you would have me fail, then you fail, for the country fails," he told them that at this moment they should be supporting him on civil rights. "I will say to those of you who belong to the party of Lincoln," he said, "that the civil rights bill was sent to Congress in May, and Judge Smith was blocking it, and Republicans, members of the party of Lincoln, were supporting Smith. He had," he said, told the businessmen, "that they either had to have two members on the Rules Committee from the party of Lincoln for civil rights, or they oughtn't to have one single Republican reelected, and they ought to have 60 or 70 or whatever you need on that petition. There, the public, is going to know who's responsible, and it's going to be right in the Republicans' lap." To the labor leaders, he spoke as a general, aware that he was speaking to men, some of whom had been his enemies but who now should be his supporters. A general rallying troops. "I need you, want you, and believe you should be at my side," he said. "This nation will be grateful to you, and so will I." Labor leaders showed their enthusiasm more visibly than business leaders. As he got to the last sentences in his speech, all around him men were standing and applauding. He had rallied them to his side, and they came. The steelworkers' 33 lobbyists were already at work, and by the end of the day the halls of the House office buildings were filled with perhaps 200 more "guys with big stomachs and big watches," in the words of a congressional aide. Lobbyists from the electrical workers and the auto workers and the railroad brotherhoods, with, behind them, the promise of labor's telephone banks, and labor's field workers, and labor's money for next year's election campaign. And there was a third meeting that day of the 200 members of the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights at a Washington hotel. And this time the anger and bitterness of these men at social injustice had a focus. Congress was no longer an amorphous problem that they couldn't solve. Johnson had given them a clear target. Meany explained that the discharge petition offered the only method that would work, the Washington Post reported, and Wilkins repeated the NAACP's intention of purging congressmen who voted against it. Johnson and O'Brien knew that the civil rights groups alone didn't have enough broad strength to get the petition signed. But among the participants in the conference were leaders of religious organizations. 4,000 priests and ministers were at that moment in Philadelphia, attending a National Council of Churches convention. The leadership conference decided to contact them and ask them to return home by way of Washington so that they could visit their representatives and urge them to vote for discharge. By that evening, in fact, an advance guard had already arrived on Capitol Hill. Negro and labor leaders are streaming in, Doris Fleeson reported, and there were clerics' collars in the halls, too. Mail to congressmen about civil rights had been increasing. That afternoon it was, one report said, heavy in favor of action now. And all day the president hammered home, over and over again, the theme he wanted emphasized, the phrase that would make it politically untenable for Republicans to keep opposing the petition. We've just got to get the party of Lincoln on that goddamn spot and keep them there and carry it right on through the election, he told O'Brien. If they're anti-civil rights, let's find out about it right now. We'll play it for keeps. By the end of Wednesday, in fact, it was over. Despite the headlines, it wasn't Wednesday morning's Republican conference with its defiant anti-petition stance that was decisive, but a quiet meeting Wednesday evening, mostly unreported at the time, between Clarence Brown of Ohio, the pro-civil rights Republican, who was the GOP's ranking member on the Rules Committee, and the committee's chairman. Brown told Judge Smith, as a later account puts it, that the heat was getting so great that Republicans, by neither signing the petition nor voting against Smith in committee, thereby in effect supporting him, were being put in an embarrassing and politically untenable position. Appealing to their friendship, Brown said he did not want to have to push him, but something had to be done. Whether or not Brown made a specific threat, he didn't have to, so clear was the situation. Two Republican votes could overrule Smith within his own committee and have the committee release the bill to the floor. Or, enough Republican signatures could be added to the discharge petition so that it would have the necessary 218. Either course would be a public repudiation of Smith's authority. Smith agreed to issue a statement, which he did early Thursday morning. This statement was somewhat different from earlier ones by the judge. Smith did not repeat that he had no plans for setting a date for hearings on the civil rights bill, and no estimate as to how long the hearings might last. Now the judge said he did have plans to begin the hearings reasonably soon in January, after Congress reconvenes. The statement was allowed to be vague, to permit Smith to save as much face as possible, but the details of Smith's surrender were clarified by Brown in a statement reinforced by Halleck. By reasonably soon, Brown explained, the chairman had meant that he would begin the hearings in early January. It would soon become known that a firm date, January 9th, had in fact been set, and that, in fact, they would only run from 7 to 10 days, in no event more than 12. That meant the hearings would be over not in March, but in January. And Halleck said that at their conclusion, the 5 Republicans on Smith's committee would promptly vote to send the bill to the floor, where it would be passed by the full House by the end of January at the latest. The press viewed the statements as merely a compromise. One of the few reporters who understood was the Times's Lewis, who noted that it was a compromise that gave the president all he could reasonably have hoped for. Johnson compromises often have that character. While Johnson wouldn't have House passage of the bill in 1963, he would have it early enough in 1964 so that the scenario he had feared, the scenario that had in fact been unfolding until he stepped in, they'll have hearings in the Rules Committee until about the middle of March, and by the time there was a House vote after that and the bill finally reached the Senate, Dick Russell will screw them to death. That scenario had been avoided. The real problem was still going to be in the Senate, but now there was going to be additional time, perhaps 2 months additional time, to solve it. House observers who knew the judge knew why he had accepted the compromise, because by accepting it he had spared himself the possible indignity of being relieved of responsibility for the bill, as the Times reported, and knew that he had been forced to accept it by the sudden new pressure behind the discharge petition from the White House. The civil rights bill was still going to face monumental difficulties when it reached the Senate in 1964, commented Newsweek, one of the few periodicals to grasp the situation, but by then Mr. Johnson will have given it quite a head start. Johnson's strategy would work, of course, only if Smith didn't renege, start to delay again when January arrived. The best way to ensure against that was to have the discharge petition still active, still on the floor, with a substantial number of signatures attached to it, so that if delays began again, enough could quickly be added to pass it. The petition was filed as scheduled on December 9th. It was actually filed not by Bolling, but by Judiciary Committee Chairman Emanuel Seller. Because of Bolling's unpopularity with the leaders, and because it was Seller's prerogative as chairman of the committee that had passed the bill to introduce it. But since Smith had agreed to a date for the hearings, many House members who had previously agreed to sign the petition were now unwilling to do so as long as Smith held to the schedule. Larry, how's that petition going? Johnson asked O'Brien, who was on Capitol Hill monitoring its progress that afternoon. There were only about 100 signatures on it, O'Brien replied. That's not as good as it should be. No, it's not, Johnson said. He put Jenkins to work applying pressure to wavering members of the Texas delegation, and four in addition to Albert Thomas's six signed before the day was over, but the total number at the end of the day was only 131. The number was small, however, because only a mere 24 Republicans had signed, and Clarence Brown had let Smith know that many more had agreed to sign in January if the judge tried to delay then, so the number was high enough. They'll sign it after the first of the year if he drags, Albert said. We can get 218 members if he drags too long. And Smith knew it. The judge had confessed to Albert that many members have been threatening to sign in January. It was too late for him to renege. Thursday, December 5th, the day Smith had surrendered, was also the day of Lyndon Johnson's lunch with Harry Byrd, the lunch at which the mood around the tax bill had started changing. So the lead headlines the next day, December 6th, were not only action in January pledged on rights, but also President wins pledge by Byrd for tax action, headlines of triumph for Lyndon Johnson. Barely 2 weeks before, when he had become president, the two most important bills before Congress had been stalled, as they had been stalled for months with no realistic sign of movement in any foreseeable future. Now, just 2 weeks into his presidency, both bills were moving. They seemed to be moving furthermore in the order he wanted, the order this master of parliamentary strategy saw as crucial. If the tax bill wasn't cleared away, wasn't passed by the Senate, before the civil rights bill arrived on the floor, it would be used to delay and kill civil rights. The two bills would, in fact, be held hostage to each other, resulting in all probability in the death of both. Despite the tough conditions Byrd had set at their lunch, however, the senator had said that if they were met, he would bring his tax bill hearings to an expeditious end. And if he approved the galley proofs of the budget that would be ready for his perusal during the first week in January, he would release the tax bill to the Senate floor, where it could be passed not long thereafter. Since, under the schedule Brown and Halleck had announced, the civil rights bill would still be in hearings before Judge Smith's Rules Committee until mid or late January, and then, by the end of January, it would be passed by the full House and sent to the Senate. If Byrd's schedule was adhered to, the tax bill would be passed, cleared from the Senate floor, before the civil rights bill arrived there from the House. They'd like to get it behind civil rights, Johnson knew, and if it gets behind civil rights, it's good night grace. Good night for the tax bill, good night for the civil rights bill. Now it seemed he had made sure the tax bill wouldn't get behind civil rights, that it would be down in the storm cellar in time. Other administration children, the appropriations bills, the education bill, the foreign aid bill, were also finally moving on through the line and would be down in the storm cellar when civil rights arrived. And now, thanks to the discharge petition, civil rights would arrive. On one of the days of that crucial, hectic, tension-filled week, the exact day is uncertain, Life magazine sent a photographer and a reporter to the Oval Office for a cover story that would run in the next week's edition. The article was not the investigative article on Lyndon Johnson's money or on Bobby Baker and Don Reynolds that, had it not been for the assassination, might have been the magazine's cover story that week, but rather on the mastery Lyndon Johnson had demonstrated in taking over the presidency. The picture on the cover would be of him standing behind his desk in the Oval Office, leaning over it and resting his weight on his big hands, looking tall and strong in a dark blue suit, with the two flags behind him, a picture that fit the headline over the article, "Texan Sits Tall in a New Saddle." The reporter was John Steele, who, having covered Johnson for many years, understood the significance of a small gesture Johnson made during the interview. On Johnson's desk was an inbox. Steele had seen that box in Johnson's vice presidential office, when there had been few documents in it, when perhaps it had been empty. Now it was filled, with documents that had to be dealt with, problems that had to be solved, decisions that had to be made. As Johnson was talking to him, Steele was to write, almost lovingly, he thumbed slowly through its jammed contents. Steele had filed thousands of words on Lyndon Johnson over the years, but he felt the man he was seeing now was a man he had never seen before. "There is in Lyndon Johnson an inner calm, a certainty of purpose," he wrote. "The small vanities, the occasional petulance, the inordinate preoccupation with what men say or write about him are gone, at least for the present. There is about him now an aura of fulfillment which in all his prior years of public office never marked the man." On the Saturday of that week, December 7th, the Johnsons moved into the White House. Lady Bird had insisted that Jackie and her children not be hurried out, but she had begun making plans for the move on November 26th, the day after President Kennedy's funeral, asking the man in charge of the internal administration of the White House, Chief Usher J.B. West, to come to the Elms. When West told her that Jackie would be taking only the furniture from her own bedroom and her children's, she said she would bring only the furniture from her own bedroom and Lucy and Linda's. She didn't want to alter the rooms Jackie had restored, she said. "I especially love the yellow oval room upstairs. It's my husband's favorite color," she told West. He quickly discovered, as he was to say, that there was nothing tentative about Claudia Alta Taylor Johnson. Looking at him intently, he was to say, she emphasized, "I want you to run the White House. I've been running a house for 30 years, and I want to devote my time to other things," she said. She was highly organized, he realized, and had very clear ideas. "I like working in a room with one door so I can control my privacy," she said. Jackie had moved out with her children to a house in Georgetown made available to her by Averill Harriman, on the morning of the 7th, and Lyndon Johnson wanted to move in that afternoon, feeling that December 7th, a date with the aura of infamy about it, was not the best possible day for the move. Lady Bird had tried to persuade her husband of that, and thought for a time that she had done so. "I think we'll probably wait until after Pearl Harbor Day," she told West. In the event, however, her wishes had received the consideration they usually received. On the morning of the 7th, moving vans began pulling into the driveway of the Elms, and at 3 o'clock, two cars pulled up to the White House, Lucy's white convertible, from which she emerged with the Johnsons' two beagles, him and her, on a leash, and a black White House limousine. Linda Bird had returned to the University of Texas in Austin. When Mrs. Johnson stepped out of the second car, she was carrying only one possession, the large framed photograph of the man with the grim face. "I had our favorite picture of the speaker, Mr. Sam Rayburn, in my hand," she was to write in her diary. "His is the only photograph of a person that we keep in our living room, wherever we are, and I wanted it with us at the White House." West escorted Mrs. Johnson and Lucy up to the private second-floor family quarters, where Lady Bird found a small vase of flowers from Jackie and a note. "I wish you a happy arrival in your new house, Lady Bird. Remember, you will be happy here. Love, Jackie." He showed Lucy her bedroom. A telephone was on the nightstand next to the bed, and she asked him, "Does this telephone go just to my room, or does it go anywhere else?" When he explained that it was connected only to the White House switchboard, and not to any telephone on the second floor, she said, "Oh, good. In our house, all our extensions were connected, and my daddy was always listening in on me." Lucy's father was not as pleased with his new quarters. 2 days after the Johnsons moved in, he told West, "Mr. West, if you can't get that shower of mine fixed, I'm going to have to move back to the Elms." He didn't sound as if he were joking, West was to say. And after the president explained that the water pressure was inadequate and that he wanted the same elaborate multi-nozzle arrangement that he had had at his former home, he repeated his threat to move out. Then, without a smile, he turned on his heel and walked away. A few minutes later, Mrs. Johnson asked West to come by the room she had chosen for her office, a small sitting room with one door. "I guess you've been told about the showers," she said with a smile, and repeated to West what she said to all Johnson employees. "Anything that needs to be done, remember this. My husband comes first, the girl second, and I will be satisfied with what's left." As he became acquainted with the Johnsons, West was to write, "I soon could see that had been her life's pattern. Nothing, he came to see, could faze her." Unexpectedly, Carl Munt's wheat amendment reared its head again. Despite Johnson's belief that he had murdered the bill, as it turned out, the death certificate bore only the Senate's signature. On December 16th, the amendment was resurrected in the House, which passed it as an amendment to the Foreign Aid Appropriations Bill, and then refused to accept a conference committee report in which the Senate conferees tried to delete it. Congress seemed ready to resume its rebellion against presidential authority, as Evans and Novak put it. Speaker McCormick again advised Johnson to let the whole foreign aid issue go over until January. For one thing, many House members had already left for the Christmas recess. The advice wasn't accepted, reminding his staff that the issue was not wheat but power, that the House as well as the Senate had to be shown who was in charge. Johnson worked on members of the conference committee, demanding of Congress, Evans and Novak said, what Congress had made clear it would not give. And on December 21st, the conferees agreed on a foreign aid bill with no Munt amendment in it. Then he ordered McCormick and the other Democratic leaders to call every Democratic congressman back to Washington for another vote in the House. When the leaders protested that the members wouldn't come, he wouldn't listen. Those who returned, he invited to a December 23rd Christmas party at the White House, at which he climbed up on a small gilt chair and shouted, "You have labored through the vineyard and plowed through the snow." And on December 24th, in a session held, perhaps for the first time in history, at 7 a.m., so that congressmen could get home for Christmas Eve, the House reversed itself. And on a party-line vote, 189-158, with the 189 including only two Republicans, finally killed the Munt Amendment for good. The earlier victory had had to be revisited. It had been. He had won again, an even more impressive victory than before. He knew exactly what he had won. At that moment, he was to write in his memoirs, the power of the federal government began flowing back to the White House. His assessment was echoed by congressmen and by observers of Congress, one of whom said that if Johnson had dodged this one, he might have been viewed on Capitol Hill as just another weak president. But by instead showing steely nerve in demanding the members' return, he had taught them once and for all that a strong hand was at the wheel. 2 hours after the vote was counted, Air Force One was in the air, carrying him back to Texas, where he would spend 13 days on his ranch over Christmas and New Year's. Chapter 21. Serenity. From Bergstrom Air Force Base outside Austin, three big olive-green Army helicopters lifted off and wheeled west. Down to the right, as Lyndon Johnson sat in the front seat of the first helicopter beside the pilot, was the pink granite dome of the state capitol, in which as a boy he had stood, as content perhaps as he was ever to be, in the rear of the House of Representatives chamber, while his father had had a seat there, and in which his father, after a while, no longer had had a seat, and near the Capitol was Austin's other dominant building, the University of Texas Tower, centerpiece of the college he hadn't been able to attend because he had had to go to the poor boys' school. And then almost immediately the helicopters were over hills. The passengers could see over the first ridges, over the ones behind them, could see the hills rolling away to the west as far as the eye could see. And Lyndon Johnson was, the moment the hills began, back in the landscape of his youth. To the four pool reporters in the third helicopter, the land below, with its trees bare and meadows gray-brown in winter, was a shock. Sere and bleak, one was to call it. So empty, another would say. We had no idea of the emptiness. The 50 miles west of Bergstrom had only two tiny villages, Dripping Springs and Henley. The miles of Texas Hill Country between them were interrupted only by the occasional farm or ranch house, or by stone chimneys jutting up out of debris where houses had once stood before their owners gave up and moved away. The helicopters, their engines as loud as thunder in that silent landscape, roared over it, scattering herds of sheep and goats as they neared. Even some of the placid white-faced Herefords were startled into lumbering a few steps. And then down to the right was a slightly larger huddle of houses and stores around a courthouse. When Lyndon Johnson had been growing up in Johnson City, the hills had added to the isolation of this island town, surrounded by a vast sea of land, the only roads out of it unpaved, rutted, often impassable in winter. The helicopters made nothing of the hills. In no more than a minute or two after Johnson City, they were over the Pernalis Valley and the Little River, as brown as the land, and were approaching the Johnson Ranch, a sprawling, comfortable, but not a huge house, only seeming huge in that land of little houses, a freshly painted white against the muted colors of the hill country, with the blue of the swimming pool beside it. And from the tall flagpole in front of the house, under the American flag, hung another flag, one that hadn't been there when he had last seen his ranch on November 21st. The sky was literally cloudless on this day before Christmas, a bright and breezy day, as would be most of the 13 days Johnson was to spend on the ranch over the Christmas break. It was that beautiful, glittering, pitiless blue sky, that sapphire hill country sky, at which his father and mother had stared day after day during those blazing hill country summers, looking in vain for a cloud that might mean rain, as their cotton and their dreams died in the drought. But fluttering against that sky now was a dark blue flag with a circle of white stars around an eagle holding an olive branch and arrows in his talons, the flag that meant that this house was the home of the President of the United States. Lyndon Johnson's changes in mood had always been violent, veering from his sad, silent spells to the periods of almost frenzied euphoria that his aides called highs. The depth of the depression he had been in when he left the Pernalis a month before was matched by the height of his elation now. He couldn't contain himself. It had been a long day, but Frank Cormier of the AP and the three other pool reporters were whisked off by helicopter to Judge Morrison's ranch, even deeper in the hills. "A Johnson we had never seen emerged at the Morrison ranch," Cormier wrote. "Gone were the low shoes, the necktie and suit. The president was wearing hand-tooled cowboy boots, an open-necked khaki shirt and a tan Stetson, which he pushed back to a rakish angle upon the familiar head. Morrison had two rifles in his hands, and Johnson took one, telling the reporters, 'The judge and I are going to do a little deer hunting, and you all can tag along if you want to.' He crammed them into the back seat of Morrison's convertible, and they headed off across the hills, bumping along rutted trails and lurching across gullies. Spotting a grazing doe, Johnson rested his rifle on the window to take aim, but lowered the gun, saying, 'I haven't got the heart to kill her.' The hunt ended without any shots being fired, but Johnson jumped out of the car happily. 'I've only been here an hour, and I feel better already,' he said. The next day, Christmas, a Wednesday, a brief photo session had been scheduled so that news photographers could take pictures of him on the lawn in front of the ranch. A full tour of the ranch house had been scheduled for Friday, and about 50 photographers, along with a dozen or so reporters hoping for a chance to ask questions during the photo session, had come out from Austin on a chartered bus. But when the picture-taking was over and they started to leave, he wouldn't let them go. His brother, his two surviving sisters, their children and other Johnson family members, 27 in all, were at the ranch for Christmas dinner, and he had them come out of the house and lined them up, ordering them about as though they were junior senators, as one reporter put it, and introduced them to the press one by one. "This is Aunt Jessie, Ms. Jessie Hatcher, who did all my cookin', washin', and sewin' for me while I was in school in Houston. This is Uncle Huffman Baines. Uncle Huffman, how old are you?" "I don't know," Uncle Huffman replied. "A very sensible answer," the president said. "He's 79, but he looks 59, and he never had but one job in his life." "A lifetime post as a telephone company engineer," he explained. "And this is Cousin Oriole, who keeps us fit, because her house was half a mile down the road from the ranch house, and he and Lady Bird walk down to see her almost every evening. And when you sit down to visit with her, you have to be mentally fit." There were 27 introductions to be made, with special attention to his daughters. "Her boyfriend is on his way here from Wisconsin," he said in introducing Lucy. "I mean one of her boyfriends." Linda was wearing her Christmas gift from her father, a loose-fitting red shift. He reached out and bundled up the fabric to prove, he said with a smile, that she wasn't in a family way. Next, he had the four secretaries he had brought from Washington, Marie Famer, Vicky McCammon, Yolanda Boozer, and his new black secretary, Jerry Whittington, come out of the house so that he could introduce them. The photographers and reporters started to leave, but he still wouldn't let them. "Come in and see our house," he said, and asked Lady Bird if there wasn't time before dinner to take the group on a tour. Actually, dinner was ready, and had been for some time, and parts of the house weren't in condition to be seen by journalists. Her mouth opened in wordless surprise and horror, one reporter was to write. "Why, yes," she managed to say. "But I'd just love to give them a wonderful tour when they come back Friday. The turkey is ready and the dressing is getting cold." There was a pause while she and her husband exchanged glances. "But whatever you say, darling." He showed them the living room with the enormous fireplace and his desk. "Don't take any pictures of the desktop. I think there are some secret documents on it." And the framed letter to Sam Houston from his great-grandfather. He was a Baptist preacher, and he was writing to renew a note at 8% interest. And the paintings, including one that he told them was his favorite, of a farm girl standing happily looking up at clouds that was named First Rain. He didn't tell them why it was his favorite. And they saw the only photograph in the room, the same photograph that was the only one Lady Bird had carried into the White House. He showed them the deer head hat rack with the deer's nose covered with red felt for Christmas. It was holding 14 hats, and he told them anecdotes about several. The tour continued. The 60 journalists arrived at the master bedroom. The door was locked. He knocked and then knocked again. "Mrs. Johnson has locked the bedroom on me," he said. She opened it a moment later. It was obvious, Time reported, that she had just finished tidying up. After he showed the group the other 6 bedrooms, Lady Bird was observed tugging on his sleeve, but all they had seen thus far was the inside. He showed them the swimming pool and explained the heating system and the family graveyard and told them who was buried there and the friendship walk, relating anecdotes about various famous guests on their ranch visits. "Go pipe that music in," he told Linda, and the Muzak in the Live Oaks was turned on. "Overflowing with energy," Cormier wrote, "the president hopped up on a stone wall, overlooking the Pernalis, and assured us the little stream could become a raging torrent, told about various floods, including the one that had almost marooned Lady Bird on the ranch, and about the dam he had built across the river." Then Cormier wrote, "With long strides, the president led us to the family hangar, to admire a new brown and white plane," the Johnsons owned, "and then to the livestock loading pens and chutes. That's where the cattle go out and the money comes in," he explained. It might, it seemed, be time to leave. The press corps started to walk toward the buses. But as Johnson turned to go inside, he had a thought. "I've got something for y'all if you'll wait a minute," he said, and sent aides hurrying off to return with large cartons containing souvenir ashtrays bearing a map of Texas with the ranch's location indicated by a star. "Only take one," he said. In unwrapping them, some of the reporters dropped the cellophane wrappers on the lawn, and one was to recall, Our final view was of our chief executive stooping to retrieve them. Then, 3 days later, on December 28th, there was a state visit from the Chancellor of the Federal Republic of Germany, Ludwig Erhard. It began with the customary formalities that attended such visits, the 19-gun salute due ahead of state as Erhard came down the ramp from his plane onto Bergstrom's red carpet, the long receiving line with Johnson at its head and the state's governor next to him, the military band playing the German and American national anthems, the honor guard parading the colors as the tall, bronzed president and the short, roly-poly, red-cheeked chancellor reviewed the ranks of rigid troops, and then mounted, along with the governor, a small stand to make brief formal statements. The only disquieting notes were the cast on John Connolly's arm, his face, gaunt and pale in the bright Texas sun, and the faces of the Secret Service men, alert and obviously concerned. Were they remembering another big plane gleaming in the Texas sun? Another red carpet, another receiving line with Johnson and Connolly at its head? But then the helicopters lifted off and headed west into the hills, and from the moment, 25 minutes later, that they touched down at the LBJ ranch, the visit became, in the words of one reporter, nothing remotely like any state visit that the journalists had ever seen. In contrast to the formalities of Washington, here, festooning the balcony over the front door of the ranch house, was Bunting in West Germany's red, yellow, and black, a huge photograph of the Chancellor, and a sign saying, Willkommen. After a photo and interview session for reporters with diplomatic staffers who picked their way in shiny black street shoes across the ranch grounds, as Newsweek put it, Johnson met with Erhard, only interpreters present, in the living room, while Secretary of State Rusk, German Foreign Minister Gerhard Schröder, and their staffs crammed into the smaller adjoining room, much too small for the group, for staff discussions. And then Johnson drove Erhard, Schröder, and Rusk out for a tour of the ranch, and stopped the car in the middle of a meadow, and the President and Chancellor discussed affairs of state, while white-faced Herefords moved closer to the car. Meanwhile, accommodations were being arranged. Between the main house and the guest house, the ranch had 8 bedrooms, but the German party numbered 25, and the State Department delegation 8. Lady Bird moved out of her bedroom, Linda and Lucy moved out of theirs into a single smaller room, other staffers moved in with ranch foreman Dale Malachek and his wife Jewel. Beds were found for everyone, and at dinner everyone crammed around 3 tables in the Johnson's dining room. The next day, Sunday, was spent in Fredericksburg, the community 19 miles to the west down the Pernalis Valley that had been settled by an ox-cart wagon train of Germans in 1846, after a harrowing months-long journey through Comanche country. With its solid stone houses crowded close to the main street, the small, neat garden plots between them, and a church in early German Gothic style, a rare bit of Nuremberg transplanted to Texas, Fredericksburg was a tiny replica of Germany in the midst of the remote Texas Hill Country, and its residents clung to German folkways. There was an annual Sängerfest, or singing contest, and the Schützenbund held frequent shooting contests, and Easter fires in the hills, and in its stores and streets, German was heard at least as much as English. Along its main street, lined with German flags for the occasion, the names on the stores were Duker's, Beckman's, Keeney's, and Schroeder's, and the cafe was the Glockenspiel. The day's special, the sign in its window proclaimed, was Eisbein, pig's knuckles, with sauerkraut. First, the president and chancellor and their staffs and security men visited the Pioneer Memorial, an octagonal replica of the Vereinskirche, the church fort built by the wagon train pioneers. The welcoming speech by Fredericksburg's mayor was in German, and emotional. "Bring our greetings back to Germany. That is the homeland of our forefathers," he said. Erhard, replying, noted that Johnson had told him that if I speak German, they will understand me better than they will understand him. Then they went to church, where the hymns and Silent Night were sung in German. When, after the ceremony, Erhard told the pastor he had been surprised by that, the pastor told him that the hymns were always sung in German. That afternoon was the state dinner held in Stonewall, a wide spot in the road between the LBJ Ranch and Fredericksburg. No one who was there is likely to forget that dinner, Cormier was to recall. The very idea of holding a state dinner in Stonewall, Texas was daring. Barely a hamlet, Stonewall had just 8 business establishments, 3 service stations, a cafe motel, 2 grocery stores, a garage, and a button factory. And even that listing makes it seem bigger than it really is. The venue for the dinner was the Stonewall High School Gymnasium, a converted wooden army barracks, rather rickety, which carpenters had been hastily patching and local housewives painting for several days in a vain attempt to conceal its imperfections. Inside, the walls had been decorated with yellow, red, and black bunting, and the basketball backboards with cutouts of German eagles. The rest of the decor was Texas. The narrow stage was a diorama of the state's symbols. Against its rear wall, a corral fence had been erected with coiled lariats on its posts and a western saddle and an Indian blanket on its top rail, from which dangled boots, spurs, and a set of stirrups. Propped against the fence were a wagon wheel and a banjo. Bales of hay completed the backdrop. In front of the fence, where the school's ancient battered upright piano usually stood, was a huge gleaming concert grand piano, so large that the stage seemed to sag a little under its weight. On the floor of the basketball court, 30 tables had been set with red and white checked tablecloths. Kerosene lanterns were the centerpieces. The dinner was Texas. A large chuck wagon had been parked near the front door by Johnson's favorite caterer, Walter Jetton of Fort Worth, the Leonard Bernstein of barbecue. And next to it were Jetton's barbecue pits on which, since 5 a.m., he and his sous chefs, their Stetsons tilted back off their faces because of the heat, had been slathering his renowned special barbecue sauce onto vast expanses of meat, 500 pounds of brisket and 300 pounds of spare ribs. The arriving guests, about 300 natives and 45 or 50 men in blue suits, were served the barbecue, together with hickory gravy, German potato salad, Texas coleslaw, ranch-baked beans, and sourdough biscuits. Then they went on inside, Lady Bird escorting Earhart, Johnson behind them, the leaders of 2 great nations carrying their own heaping plates across the crowded gymnasium, filled with smoke and aroma from the barbecue spits. Dessert was a German chocolate cake baked from a recipe carried by the original pioneers, and the men in blue suits drank beer from paper cups, and with dessert, coffee from tin cups. Strumming guitars, a country music band, the Wanderers 3, augmented to 4 members for the occasion, was gathering rainbows and handing out schemes with a heart full of heather and a pocket full of dreams. And the ambiance in the little country gymnasium was Texas, too. Nothing at all like a formal state dinner in the White House. And in its informality and friendliness, very much like a typical Texas speaking, the diplomats eating spare ribs with their hands and making return trips to the chuck wagon. Earhart's once heaping plate was empty by the end of the meal. A warm buzz of talk and laughter filled the hall, much of it in German as Fredericksburg's townspeople chatted happily with the representatives of the homeland. Up at the head table, Lady Bird and Earhart, despite their language differences, were talking together like old friends. And after dinner, the entertainment was also Texas. The master of ceremonies was Cactus Pryor, the George Jessel of Texas. He apologized to the chancellor because they had been unable to find a way to barbecue sauerkraut. There was a Mexican mariachi band, square dances by the Billiettes, a precision dance team, not all that precise, from Fredericksburg High School, and then German carols sung by cowgirls. The St. Mary's High School choir in full cowgirl regalia. Stetsons, blue skirts, white blouses, and red neckerchiefs, under the direction of a nun in head-to-toe black habit. They closed with Deep in the Heart of Texas, and that was in German, too. Die Sterne bei Nacht sind groß und klar, tief in das Herz von Texas. After each verse, the traditional 4 Texas claps. At the conclusion, a cowboy yell echoed by the audience. Only after that did the explanation of the grand piano appear. Tall, curly-haired Van Cliburn of Fort Worth, whom newspapers had been calling the pride of Texas ever since his victory in 1958 in the first international Tchaikovsky competition in Moscow. The thunderous chords of the young virtuoso's selections from Beethoven, Brahms, and other German composers filled the rickety little building. Formal the dinner may not have been, it was, however, a triumph. Erhardt's smile grew broader and broader with each German song. As the cowgirls were singing the carols, he leaned back, lit up a long cigar, and puffed on it for the rest of the meal, his bright blue eyes sparkling, his face a picture of red-cheeked contentment. When they got to Die Sterne bei Nacht, he almost broke up with laughter, a reporter wrote.